from the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, you're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Elena Kapoman Davis, Quinault Nation citizen and descendant of the Grovant tribe and Hoopa tribe, will graduate from Gonzaga with her MBA in American Indian Entrepreneurship in May 2024. She discusses some of her business endeavors, reconnecting with Native culture, and the importance of leveraging the entrepreneurial spirit of Indian country.
Currently, MBA AIE student. And are you in that cohort graduating this spring? Are you guys graduating this spring?
Correct. Yeah, okay. Next month.
Congratulations. It's going to be awesome. Yeah. And I guess that makes sense because we have the round dance coming. See, this, I'm always slow on the uptake. I'm always slow. But yeah, if you know, obviously you've gone through the Gonzaga journey, but tell me a little bit about, you know, before you got to Gonzaga, how you found Gonzaga. I know you had some entrepreneurial ventures with some native, was it like dress, traditional dress and clothing or something like that? I'll let you tell me the story.
Hey, Siokwil. Yes, I've kind of dabbled in making regalia since I was a child. My auntie Michelle, or we call her Ponozekwa, that's her Saboba name, and my mother, Natsa Abe, they are both seamstress. They are amazing. They can make wedding dresses. And when it's pretty much their era, a cultural resurgence started happening and they started making regalia. So I learned, you know, sit on my mom's lap at the sewing machine and at the fabric store, just having fun running through all the bolts of fabric. So I have a lot of fond memories of growing up and just that sense of community and family is always really embedded in the regalia making. So it's something I do to relax, but I did do it for a while as just a sole source of income. And that was kind of stressful, but I've had really good teachers and I have amazing artists in my family. So this painting behind me is one of my relatives, Natchaktua. He's the head of my Kapoman family. He's a seated hereditary chief and amazing artist. He's a politician. And I've always leaned back on the culture and making regalia. And I love seeing anything I make on the dance floor or at a ceremony. Just makes me so happy. And my children are really spoiled. They have a ton of regalia. So.
Awesome.
But really my journey at Gonzaga started with my mom, as most things in my life do. She attended I had to ask her, 1969 to 1971.
Okay.
At the time, the Bureau of Indian Affairs provided scholarships for students because there was no way that her family could afford it. She was the first person in the family to attend higher education. So she was able to go for 2 years, and she studied philosophy and anthropology. And she said her time at GU was the best in her life. Like, she loved it there. So she just couldn't say enough about GU. Unfortunately, the scholarship dissolved, so she had to leave. And she went to back home, and she taught at the local community college. And that's where she met my father. But she went on. She went to UW, and eventually she went to U of A and became an attorney.
Fantastic.
Yes. But then more recently, I have two dear friends, Talina Ives and Melanie Montgomery. Talina is a member of the Port Gamble Sklallam tribe over here in Washington. And Melanie is a member of my tribe. And they both went through the organizational leadership program at Gonzaga.
Okay.
Awesome. Melanie graduated. Yeah. Melanie graduated during the pandemic. So as you know, they couldn't do the walk or have any of the celebrations. So she was able to, her class walked after the pandemic was over. And that's when my friend Talina finished. And so they got to walk in the same time. And that was my first time on campus and celebrating with them and seeing the beautiful campus. And then they both encouraged me to look at their program. So I was poking around the website, and I saw the MBA AIE program, and I was like, what? This is right up my alley. And I'd been doing social work for Indian child welfare for a long time. And you know, that was really hard on your heart, and especially working in Indian country. I spent about 20 years doing that. So I wanted to change. I wanted to look more into the entrepreneurship that I'd always been interested in, kind of legitimize it. So I applied. I did the interview with Marietta, and I almost fell over when I got the information that I was accepted. I was so excited. And my husband had really encouraged me, because higher education's always been hard for me. I'm hyperactive, so sitting at lectures has never been a way for me to learn very well. And Sonny encouraged me to go, and he went through UW's business program, and he was the manager of one of our enterprises at our tribe, the Quinault Nation. That's the whole story.
that's awesome. You know, it's the family connections at Gonzaga run deep in a lot of ways. I hear a lot of stories of, how'd you find out about Gonzaga? Family, one way or the other. And it was a special experience. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in the MBA AIE program? I'm so confined to my accounting world. I have a very basic understanding of the program, which I understand you have a cohort, I think it's 2 years, a small group of people. So you guys are tight. And you come to campus maybe once a semester. Does that sound right? I'll let you kind of fill in the details, but and more just about your experience and how it was. And I think you guys went to New Zealand once, so you can talk about that too. So, maybe you didn't, I don't know.
Yes, so there are 11 of us, and we call ourselves Cohort Now, but I believe we are the 14th cohort of the MBA AIE program. We have educators, social people that work in social services, city government, tribal finance and natural resources, a native CDFI. We have an architect, we have a journalist, and then I work for the federal government. So we're pretty spread out, and not just in our chosen field, professional field. Elijah comes all the way up to campus from his reservation, the Diné, the Navajo Nation in Arizona.
Yeah.
And Charity Vu comes over from Bemidji, Minnesota, the Leech Lake and Red Lake Ojibwa. And a couple in Montana, a couple of us in Washington, one in Idaho. So when we first got together, it was pretty interesting just learning about each other. And then we pretty much became siblings in some ways, you know, really supporting each other, some of us, and then spending so much time together and working on projects. That whole kind of sometimes painful learning process. But we're all, I was checking in with some of them, and some of them are pretty sad we're not going to see each other as much anymore, but, you know, making plans to go on trips. And I'm sure we'll run into each other in Indian country, because you just run into people. Like, I always meet cousins when I travel for work or go to an Indigenous conference or meeting. So the first semester started with our summer immersion, and we came to campus for 2 weeks, and I had never had a dorm experience. Yeah. And I was pretty excited. I have two children. They're now 11 and 13, and they got to come with me. We stayed in a family dorm. I brought my e-bike over, and we cruised around campus and took them to the library. And after that, they made forts out of the little semi bunk beds they have in the dorms, and they were just having the best time. But after that, they've been talking about, like, am I going to go to GU? Where am I going to go to college? And I'm like, it's really up to you. You can go to GU if you want to. Let's make sure those grades are good. Let's really learn this math. And so I really appreciated that experience. That was pretty incredible. And we got to watch the fireworks from the little lawn at our dorm, because it was the 4th of July then. My first class, I think, that impacted me the most was Kathy DeHart's accounting, how excited she is about accounting. At first I was like, what is up with this lady?
Yeah, totally.
She's so positive, and she's so energetic about accounting. And I remember, you know, being skeptical, and math has never really been my strong suit. So I really had to work hard in her class, but she was so supportive, would answer my emails and phone calls anytime. And I remember we were working on balance sheets. She's like, watch this. It's going to be magical. I'm like, it is? And then it zeroed out. And I was like, yes. I was like running around. I was like, that's so beautiful. She's like, I know. So I thought that was pretty amazing that she got me that emotionally invested in accounting. And I told, like, I'll be looking, you know, around on Google Finance and I'll understand a lot more things. And when I'm looking at my tribe's annual reports, we have meetings where all tribal members come together and we get reports on our enterprises, on our government, and we elect leaders. We ratify new members. There's just a whole bunch of things that happen, like even appointing fishing grounds, which is, you know, part one of our treaty rights. And so we just had that 2 weekends ago, and looking at those reports, I'm like, oh, but how can they, what happened here? And so I really appreciate that now, because before I'd be like, eh, all right, whatever. So yeah, I love Kathy and I've stayed in touch with her. And I think that's one of the relationships that I'll have for, you know, for the rest of my time here on Earth. Another teacher I found fantastic was Danielle. She was fantastic. So I work a full-time job. I have 2 kids. I volunteer quite a bit on different boards and things. But she would answer my phone call at 7 p.m. on Saturday, or my text. And I'm like, I'm really stuck on this question. Please just, whenever you have time, can we get together before the assignment's due? And she would call me like that and get on a Zoom and I'd be like, oh, and she'd really help me. So just the faculty have been amazing. Another, I think, important aspect to the program is how the alumni are brought back as adjunct professors. Yes. So I've had Izzy Asana, Jordan Thompson, Veronica Vu, they all been through the program. They understand what we're going through and what we're trying to accomplish. And they make it relevant, all of the teachings really relevant to our communities and help us push and understand how we're going to be a positive influence for our tribes. And so I just can't say enough about the program. And I got to meet somebody who was accepted into the next cohort when I was at the Reservation Economics Summit last month. And she was like, what's it like? Tell me. And I'm like, oh girl, you're gonna have the best time. It's amazing, but I have some tips. So we're gonna get together and
awesome.
help her get ready. But you are right. We did go to Aotearoa. We did a study abroad with the University of Auckland, and 9 of us were able to go, I believe, or was it 10? 10 of us went out of the 11. And that was, I've been there before. So I knew some Waka, the canoe people there. I knew a family. And the faculty at University of Auckland were great. It was cool to see their campus. And then the itinerary they set up for us. We went to an iwi, we went to museums, we got to talk to Indigenous professors about colonialism and then what they're doing for entrepreneurship. And I found that particularly interesting because they do a lot of tourism. And that's something that I would like my tribe to explore is cultural tourism. We have such beautiful territory and I think we could be maximizing that to improve our economy, keep some of the money in our community.
Right.
Yes, that's one thing I wanted to mention about the application process was finding out that the Johnson Foundation provides half of our scholarship.
Yeah.
And that made it accessible for me. I couldn't afford the tuition otherwise. And for some reason, I've never really been successful with scholarships. So we got to meet them, a bunch of them too. They came out and met us when we were at the ACES conference. They had a reception and we got to meet some of their higher ups. And that was a pretty cool experience too.
That's awesome. I mean, it's an incredible foundation. And I have zero connection with it. I just, from what I've heard from folks that work with it, it's such a cool project. And I almost feel like we need to have a reunion of all the cohorts at some point. And just because, as you mentioned, making connections and how you can leverage, you know, experience and expertise, I think it's a lot what we're about. And I mean, it sounds particularly applicable to your guys' experiences, you know, and it's, well, that's, it's a beautiful thing. So you're currently at Census, and are you doing specifically Native American work there, or okay, very cool. Explain a little bit about that. What's the I know you did a presentation for us, which was I wasn't able to make, but I heard nothing but good things about it. So,
yes. So I am a tribal relations specialist with the U.S. Census Bureau. I report to the Los Angeles Regional Office. So it's located in Burbank. And our coverage area is Alaska, Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Nevada, California, and Hawaii. So I am responsible for engaging all those tribal nations, the Hawaiian homelands, and the Alaskan territories too, the different tribes up in Alaska. So I have, I think, about 350 tribes that I'm trying to make connections with. And
wow,
it's really, yeah, it's really to honor the government-to-government relationship and the federal trust responsibility that the U.S. Census Bureau is an extension of that. And I'm fortunate that our director of the Census Bureau, he's the first Latino man. His name is Robert Santos, and I've gone on 4 trips with him now. Every time he travels and he's in our region, he's like, Elena, introduce me to more tribal people. I really need to understand. And so I love it when he travels over, and he is just a fantastic person. He says, like, he recognizes the Census Bureau hasn't always been, you know, the best thing for Indian country, but he wants to work on repairing that. And he really tells the leadership, you know, we're holding your data. This is yours. So please let Elena help you access it. There's free trainings. Anything you need, please work with Elena. And so I just, I really appreciate how he takes the time whenever he's traveling to make sure and meet different communities, because we are all so different. There's 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States, and putting one kind of lens on us just doesn't work. You know, I'm Coast Salish, I'm Quinault, but I'm also a descendant of the Hoopa tribe of California and the Anayanan, the white clay people, which on the federal registry were called the Grovant. That's my mother's enrolled there. My grandfather was Little Shell Chippewa, and my great grandmother was from Squaxin Island. And on a census, she's listed as 4/4 Quinault when she was actually no Quinault when she was married to my great grandfather. Okay. She didn't even speak our language. That was kind of the culture then, was, you know, you bring in fresh blood because it's really taboo to marry anyone or have children with someone you could even remotely be related to. So I just find that interesting too, when you talk about the issues with blood quantum and, you know, who's a real Indian and those kinds of things, and the way that our communities viewed them, especially mine, I can really only speak for mine, is that if you came to our community and you contributed and you were one of us, then you were Quinault. So I started with the Census Bureau in 2010. I was recruited to be a tribal partnership specialist. They were trying out this new program because they were having trouble getting an accurate count of Indian country. And they realized, they're like, oh gosh, this is so complex. We need to try to recruit indigenous people to work with the tribes and tribal organizations, tribal nonprofits, the schools, just everything. So I covered Washington, Oregon, and I worked a little bit in Idaho and Alaska. For 2020, I came back and I covered Washington. I was made the state lead, and there were 3 other partnership specialists. So we covered just Washington. So we're getting ready for 2030 now. I think it's later this month or next month, we're going to be announcing the test site for 2026. And one of them will include Indian country. And I don't know who it is. We're excited to see. But they really want to try out some new ideas to make sure we get a fair and accurate count.
Right. Right. I mean, that your job sounds incredible, by the way. It's a combo of being, you know, I love data, and you must travel to beautiful places and meet incredible people, or at least get to connect with them on some level. I mean, where are some of the cool places you've been or traveled to in Alaska or Idaho or anywhere?
Yeah, I was just going to say the most recent trip that was so impactful is the an organization in Alaska got funding from Census Equity and asked me to come up and do a presentation on the American Community Survey. Their goal was to translate messages in ACS, we call it American Community Survey, ACS, I'm sure you're familiar, into 9 different Alaska Native languages. So there were panels of different linguists there, elders. There was a baby in the room. There was a two young, I'd say in their 20s, who were learning their language. And they asked me so many amazing questions, some things I'd never thought of. You know, some of the challenges they face in Alaska are just so different than what I've experienced here in Washington. So I spent 3 days with them, and it was pretty incredible. They're going to be releasing the things they came up with, and I think in June, and they're hopeful that they'll get a better count for the American Community Survey. You know, that's the one that used to be part of the decennial census. It was a long form. So now when you see the decennial, it's just the 10 questions. The ACS is about, I think it's like 46 questions, and it's much more of a deep dive into your educational attainment, your utilities, your household, how far you have to commute to work. Like it's a whole bunch of really detailed questions that provide us a much better picture of what a community needs. Like, do they need new roads? Do they need schools? Like in Alaska, they need access to fresh water that they can actually drink, and roads, definitely roads. So they found it very important to encourage their community to respond to this survey whenever they're selected in the sample. So every month, 250,000 households are selected across the country in the sample, and they represent sometimes 100 people, sometimes 1,000 people, their answers do. So it's important that everybody really take the time to do it. And it's kind of crazy because 3 months ago, I received it. I got put in a sample, and it's random. Like the LARO doesn't know who's going to be in the sample. And so I got to do it, and I was like, wow, this took me like 40 minutes.
Yeah, right, right.
And I had to look at like, what did I pay for? Like, what's my average utility cost for this, you know, this part of the house, that part of the house? What do I pay for garbage and that kind of thing? So it was really interesting to go through it. And I have a really supportive boss at the Census Bureau. I said, you know, I'd really love to do the training as a field representative for ACS. Because what part of my job is to help the on the ground, you know, boots to the ground workers that go and knock on the doors of people don't self-respond and try to capture that data. And one of my roles is to ensure we have access to tribal lands, that we've asked permission and that they've granted it. Otherwise, we can't go on to tribal land. Right. And then I also asked them to appoint a liaison because there's so much going on at Census Bureau. We conduct over 130 surveys a year. Most people don't realize that. They think it's just decennial. But one that's closing out this month is the Boundary Annexation Survey, and that's the opportunity for governments to let us know if their boundaries have changed and what their legal, what their name is, if they've changed their name. So it's really important to Indian Country because if they have acquired more of their territory back, you know, bought it back, turned it into trust, then that expands their boundaries. They have jurisdiction over that land. So it's we do that once a year. And I've been reaching out to all of my tribes to encourage them to let us know, like, if even if there weren't changes, it just takes 2 minutes. And then that really helps, you know, helps.
I mean, and everything. On its face, it might seem like unimportant, like I'm filling out my utility, but it's so important. The data is so valuable. Do you face, is there some skepticism? I mean, I would imagine if I were a member of a tribe, given the history of how the government has treated tribes, like I would be like, it was kind of like me with the IRS. I'm like, I don't know if I want to give you this information, right? So I imagine there's some challenges there.
Yes,
to get people to participate, you know, but.
Yeah, absolutely. There's distrust of government. You know, a lot of times the data was used against us, and there's been a big movement about data sovereignty and who should hold that information.
That makes perfect sense. We talk about it with Facebook and everything else. I mean, it's powerful stuff. So interesting.
Yes.
So a couple of things that caught my attention. You talked about cultural tourism, and I want to ask you about that kind of in the context of maybe what's next after you get your degree in the spring. But before, can you give me a little more background? I mean, when I think of your homeland, beautiful, beautiful oceans. Tons of fish resources. But then you have like the mountains right there too that are absolutely beautiful. And I I mean, I would imagine, I want to learn a little more about Quinault's culture and what's sacred and kind of how that might tie into cultural tourism or something to that effect. I hope that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. And I've been really curious about it too. Excuse me. There are some tribes that are already doing it and they're being really successful, but they're still protecting what's sacred to them while educating people about who they are. You know, like I said, you can't just cast one blanket across Indian country and you cover all of us. Like we're all so diverse. Even, you know, just going down to the Columbia River, they're just so different from the Quinault. But that was one of the places we would meet to trade. That was a traditional area where we would bring things down there, and people would come from up from California and over. So it was a huge hub. The Quinault Nation, our treaty was signed July 1st, 1885, and there were leaders from seven different tribes. So that's why we're a nation. There are some tribes that have federal recognition, like the Quileute Nation, the Quileute tribe. You can, if you meet their enrollment criteria, you can enroll there, or you can choose to enroll with Quinault Nation. So long as we just changed this year, which I'm so excited about. We used to have blood quantum. You had to be one quarter of the seven affiliated tribes. It could be any combination. Then you're eligible for citizenship. And as I'm sure you know, citizenship is a major part of sovereignty, determining who your members are. So I've always taken it very seriously. I volunteered on our enrollment committee for 6 years and reviewed every application, looked at their family tree, made sure that they met the criteria before we would sign off and make them a citizen of our tribe. So our treaty, we ceded most of the Olympic Peninsula. It was a huge territory. And we have two villages now, Queets and Tohola. And we have the largest land base in Western Washington. And as you said, it's gorgeous, you know, temperate rainforest, mountains. I go hunting up in the mountains. We have a lake. We have a lot of rivers. And then we have the ocean. So we have pretty diverse enterprises in that. We have Quinault Pride Seafoods, which is a fish processing plant. So we buy from fishermen, process it, and then sell it all over the world. And it's really good. It's really good seafood. If you're hungry, order some from there. But the land is just, it's so beautiful. Like I go, whenever I'm home, there's one particular beach I go to because like no one's there. And all of our beaches are closed to the public. You can only be on them if you're a tribal member. And that was in response to, you know, in the 70s, I believe it was, or early 80s, a lot of people were coming out and not being respectful, leaving a lot of garbage. So we closed our beaches, just tribal members now.
Yeah.
One of the things we do is for subsistence is hunting, fishing, you know, digging razor clams. So I'm excited when I get the email like, hey, there's five tides coming up. I'm like, all right, what time are they? And is it a minus tide? And what beaches are open? And take my kids out there and I try to teach them. But my daughter, who's 11 now, always ends up just playing in a tide pool, even in the middle of winter.
Of course.
So it's still a great experience for her, right? She's seeing me provide food for the family. And she does catch some of the, I mean, it's a skill. If you've ever, have you been clam digging before, razor clam digging?
Well, I've tried unsuccessfully, but not like with anyone who like knows what's going on, showing me how it's done. It was basically like, oh, let's see if we can get a clam, and no chance. So yeah. So no, answer officially no.
Well, sometime I'll go out to Ocean Shores. I'll meet you and show you how
awesome.
To do it. Cause
awesome.
For a while that was a way to, they have commercial clam digs for the fish house I told you about, where the beach is just full of Quinaults digging as much as they can in a three to four hour window. The most clams I've dug is 300 pounds.
What?
And that's with a shovel. And you just like, my hand got bruised. I had bruises all in my elbow, like blisters. Cause yeah, you have to dig in the sand. Like you don't want to dig more than twice or you're wasting energy. You pinch them by their little necks and pull them up and throw them in your surf sack. And so, yeah, I think I passed out for a good 3 hours afterward. And then I took, you know, a hot shower and then iced my elbow and my hand. And then I ate a bunch of clams. So,
yeah, right. Fresh clams. So how does it work? Is it, is like you see, do you see the little air hole they have and then you got to go quickly?
They respond to pressure in the sand. So if you're walking, you'll see them suck down and that's when the hole kind of appears. But if a tide's coming in and there's like that brown kind of, it looks kind of scummy, but it's actually, they love eating it, little planktons and things. So you'll see them, we call it necking, where their little mouth is up and they're like collecting little things. So if you're quick, you can just grab it like that. Otherwise you need to dig. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, you'll see us like holding our surf sacks up and like stomping. That's so that they feel the pressure and suck down and we know where they're at.
Interesting. This is why I had no chance of ever getting a clam. Wow. So what have you seen like on the cultural tourism? Because I it sounds like, and it would make sense, it's a fine line to walk, right? We want to preserve our traditions and our culture and not have Disney World in our backyard where everyone's going to be trampling around. And, you know, so what would you envision in your homeland, you know, on the West Coast there?
I'm still kind of percolating on it, but I'm a canoe puller. I've been a canoe captain. So every year the tribes in Washington, some in Oregon, and then in Canada, one of the tribes declares they're going to be host a couple of years ahead of time. Okay. So all the canoes, a lot of them leave from their homeland. So we would leave from Tohola. We call it shooting the mouth. So you're in the little bay there. And then when you see the tide is right as a captain, you take your crew out the mouth of the river and sometimes you catch air just boom back in. And so there's a lot of tips to that too, how to navigate that correctly. But we travel and we call it the highway of our ancestors. The first leg of the trip is usually to La Push, and I believe it's 57 nautical miles that we pull. There's the canoe I usually go in is called Me'i. It's named New Beginning. And that was in response to, you know, our longhouses were burned, our canoes were burned, when our children were taken to boarding schools, when we were punished for speaking our language, we lost a lot of things. So we didn't have any canoes until Me'i was brought back to us by one of our tribal elders. He taught all our young men how to carve things he remembered from growing up as a child and as a young man. So Me'i she's my baby. I love that canoe. It's a old growth cedar carved in the traditional manner. She weighs over a ton and she's so stable. And I love when I can sail in her. We have a seat that has a hole in it and we just put a cedar log up there with a sail. And I really get bruised then because I have a long paddle, but I'm pretty much the rudder. And there's usually two seats. The two seats ahead of me help me keep on track because we'll go up to 9 nautical miles an hour when the sail's up, which you're just holding your paddle. That maybe doesn't sound fast to you, but it feels amazing on the water.
I would imagine. How many people in the canoe?
In Me'i, she can hold 13. We have another one. It's called Wolf's Coat. Topit Kapu, Wolf Coat. Right now, with those were our first two. Now we have a lot. In our way, families would have their own canoes. So in more recent years, families have been fortunate enough to get the logs and have the knowledge or learn. Somebody teach them how to carve canoes. And I think we have like over 13 canoes on the water now when all of us are out, which is pretty good for a tribe. Before this year, there was about 3,500 of us. And at this last general council, when I was telling you we changed to descendancy, we enrolled 595 new citizens through descendancy. So, and I'm really excited about that. You know, we want to be here. We want to maintain our tribe. And Blood Quantum was a way for them to try to get rid of us. So, one of my ideas for cultural tourism, and I would take a canoe up to Lake Quinault and take people out, just people that were interested and wanted to learn. Yeah. And Aramark has a property up there, the Lake Quinault Lodge. And they came out, they're like, we want to hire you. I'm like, no way, I'm not doing this for you. Like, you're not making all the money off of this. And
right.
Because I sing our songs when I'm in the canoe and I share stories. And
yeah,
it really is It's a great experience.
And that's awesome. Go on. Sorry. That's so awesome.
Well, and you say it's awesome, but you haven't heard me sing. So okay. I'm a dancer. I've always been a dancer, and people say my singing voice is okay, but it's really a necessity when you're pulling and when you're a captain, because there are different songs for different types of water. You know, if I see the fog dropping, or if I see the water doing something where I feel like we need to go faster, I'll sing a fast song. If I know that we're getting tired and the water's good, the current's going our way, I can sing a slower song to give them a little bit of a break. And then it really keeps people going. I learned to sing out of necessity. And that's one thing that we're really proprietary about. If you don't have permission to sing someone's song, you're going to get in big trouble.
Yeah.
You know, we were a potlatch society. We believed in distributing the wealth. So, but that's something you'll get in big trouble for if you're singing a song you don't have permission for.
So
a lot of times, if you come to our celebrations, you'll see somebody announce, you know, this song was gifted to us by Natoktua on the paddle to Puyallup in 1993. Like, they tell that history. So everybody knows, like, oh, okay, it's okay. We don't have to get into fisticuffs about this. So.
Wow. And again, I'm exposing my complete ignorance. You use the word potlatch, I think, and I've seen it before. Can you explain what that means? You kind of talked about sharing a sharing society, but what is it? Is like an event called a potlatch that you did? It's like a gathering or anything like that. What's that mean?
My understanding, which I'm constantly learning too, you know, we're rediscovering a lot of things as well. Potlatches were celebrations of a redistribution of the wealth.
Okay.
I was able to hold a potlatch when I got my oldest son initiated into the Wolf Society, and he received his name. He was 6 years old at the time, and 3 or 4 of my cousins and I got together. So we pooled resources. We got together and wove cedar bark. We made earrings. We prepared other small gifts. We went hunting and fishing and gathering for traditional foods. We worked on regalia. And so typically in that kind of, you know, it's a celebration, but there's some serious cultural work that gets done. So some things we just don't talk about, but in general, starts with a big meal, usually traditional foods, salmon, elk, deer, sometimes seal, a lot of clams, halibut, and just anything we can really get our hands on because it's all good.
Right.
We harvest our teas, and you know, we make fruit leather, things like that, out of elder salal berries, salmon berries, blackberries, huckleberries. It's all really good.
It might be like one of the healthiest diets in the world, you know, if we're eating shellfish, wild meats, you know, salmon. Is there now, the big canoe tradition, is there a history with hunting whales, bigger fish at all? I think on the top of the peninsula there may be a tribe that had a history with that. I'm forgetting the name, of course.
The Macaw.
Yeah, it was Quinault. Did they have something similar with hunting whales? That sounds scary to me, but you got to be a big, strong captain to make it happen.
My understanding is that we were the southernmost whale hunting tribe, and we did hunt whales. Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Yeah, and during the time when the Macaw brought that back, it was a huge celebration for us. Several canoe families volunteered to come out and help kind of run decoy because there were people trying to stop them and trying to cause them harm. Right. But the celebration when they got their whale and brought it ashore. So I got to have some whale blubber. I chewed on that thing for about 4 days. It was like the bubble gum that would never end. But the Macaw have beautiful dances, and their songs are so rich in their language. Everybody loves when the Macaw take the floor during a celebration or a potlatch. So after you eat at a potlatch, clear the floor gets blessed. And then typically the one doing the work. So for example, with my son and my relatives, We brought them out and did the work to give them their names. And then we do a thing called rolling the drum to the people that traveled the furthest. So they take the floor and they share their songs. They share their maybe lessons to the person that's being held up and celebrated. And they gift. And after everybody has a turn, and snacks are given out this whole time. Typically potlatches will last 3 days, like night and day, night and day, night and day. You don't stop till everybody's shared what they want to share. And at the end, the host does their giveaway, all their special gifts for people. And then everybody receives gifts like jam that you've made throughout the year, canned salmon, different clothing. And unfortunately, we have really depended on stores like Walmart for our giveaway items. So I do say they make the best fry bread bowls. You can really use that fry bread bowl for years. But one of the things that I really want to do with my MBA is work on, you know, our tribal economy, making sure the dollar circulates 4, 5, 6, 7 times. And there has been a lot of new entrepreneurs coming out making earrings. Like I just got these this week from Jimmy Price, who's a Port Gamble scholar. He had a little case at the tribal gas station, you know, being really creative like that. And I was like, oh yeah, I need new earrings. I'm going to get
those. Totally, totally. It's always a good time for new earrings, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think my boyfriend would that totally, a lot. No, he wouldn't. He's very supportive. But making sure that we are spending money back in our communities and in other tribal communities and helping them be successful as entrepreneurs. Because, you know, he's an artist, he's a carver, and he's trying something new with the earrings. These are acrylics, you know, using modern materials, but this is a shell, and these designs.
It's awesome.
A crescent in a little, so, you know, those are meaningful, even though they're new materials. I mean, we were entrepreneurs back in the day, and if there was a better way of doing something, we would adopt that. Mm-hmm. So I like that blend of kind of innovation in culture. And that's something I really want to support, helping these small entrepreneurs make sure that they're filing their taxes correctly so they don't get in trouble with the IRS, you know, your favorite org there.
Yeah, right.
Making sure that their price point is correct, making sure that they have the good projections, that they're doing it, they understand how to keep their books or find somebody that can do a good job keeping their books so they can focus on the art. Marketing is another thing that I really enjoy. Marketing and promotions of things, really getting people hyped up about something. And
right.
Hey, check out this artist. Look at this cool stuff he's doing. Oh man, his price point's amazing. You should get on it before they're gone. And, you know, so I love being kind of an advocate for Native entrepreneurs.
That's because you're a natural leader. That's why you like to.
You
speak of entrepreneurship. Dan Stewart, who we mentioned early, and I'll, for the folks listening, member of the Spokane Tribe on the faculty here. I was in his office once, probably wasting his time, probably wanted me to leave, but he gave me an article that it was under review at a journal. He was a co-author of it, and it was on Native American entrepreneurship. And there was a story in the abstract, which I thought was incredible. You may have heard it, but it was something to the effect of the Lewis and Clark group. They had traded early on, and it was like a specific axe that they made a trade. And then later when they were, I don't know, somewhere in the Columbia Valley, that axe came up again, like showed up. The axe beat them. So there was such an active trading and economy between tribes that it beat Lewis and Clark's, I guess they called it the core of discovery, which is kind of ironic because they were discovering there were people there, right? There was nothing new to discover, I guess, from the European perspective. But yeah, I thought that was an incredible story. So,
and you know, that book was my first exposure to Dan because I went through a program in Seattle through Native Action Network. It's called Legacy of Leadership, where you apply and you become part of we're all people that identify as female. and it's a leadership development program. It's 9 months. You meet every month and you learn about local government. You learn about different organizations such as El Centro de la Raza in Seattle. You go visit places like Chief Seattle Club, which is a native nonprofit focused on addressing homelessness and making sure that people have the resources they need. And they have a partnership with the Seattle Indian Health Board, which is the primary organization providing medical services and mental health. And they've expanded into like holistic traditional healings. They were a big help during the COVID-19 epidemic, but all these partnerships within these tribal organizations, making sure that urban Indians get everything they need and they have a community. So we've learned all about them. And one of the professors that we went and spoke to at University of Washington was Kennedy. And she wrote that book with Dan, and she assigned us that that whole book to read before the time we met with her. So I was like, wow, this guy sounds really cool. And so when I got my syllabus, and I was like, damn, Stuart's going to be one of my professors. Yes. And so I made a point of telling him, I really enjoyed your book. I hope you keep writing. And I've enjoyed some of the conversations I've been able to have with him. Yeah, he's a great guy.
One of my best friends on the faculty, and I probably much to his chagrin, because he's got important work to do, and I'm always just kind of kind of playing around. But on the regalia that you've done, you were doing that for multiple tribes across the country, is that right, or is it just more local tribes?
Well, I'm fortunate that I have so many different tribal backgrounds. So my mother's people wore buckskin. They did the ribbon work. They did the bead work.
That's so cool. This is going, go on. This is going to be so cool.
And my father's, my Quinault Nation, you know, we would harvest cedar bark from trees, and the season's coming up now. When the pitch starts to run is when you go harvest cedar bark. And that is exhausting, because you use a hatchet, make a little line, you dig your little hands under the bark and you grab some, and you just run back and pull one strip. Just one per tree.
Yeah.
Because then you aren't damaging the tree. It'll be able to recover from that. And then you have to sit there and peel all that outer bark off. And then you roll it up and you store it for a year so it can season and that pitch can dry. And then you can start processing it further to weave. And we did all kinds of baskets to hold water, to hold berries, to hold children, to hold our salmon, to make nets out of, make rope out of. We made our clothing out of it. You pound the cedar bark and then you can weave it, and it gets really soft if you do it the right way. We made capes out of that to keep the rain off of us. You know, we went barefoot because it's a rainforest. There's just moss and slugs and mud and water everywhere.
Right.
Where our reservation, it rains a lot, which I love it. A lot of people find it hard, but I can't stand too much sunshine. Sometimes when I'm in Spokane, I'm like, oh, away sun.
I'm with you.
It is nice. It's beautiful over there. I found some really lovely spots when I'm out hiking to see the territory there. But yeah, cedar and salmon are really foundations of our community. And we have adopted some more modern practices. You know, when fabric came to us, we started making wool button blankets. And so it's shells. You cut out designs by hand. Usually the blanket is your family design, so that when people see you, they know who you are. And that's primarily for snagging purposes. You know, I mentioned you can't go after someone you could possibly be related to. And I have a funny story about that. In high school, so my adopted dad raised me. He's Sac and Fox and Kickapoo from Oklahoma. And when my mom went to ASU, moved us from our territory in Washington, my territory, in August to Tempe, Arizona, and entering my teen years. So she was really setting herself up, you know. So we get there, and I'm just laughing at what a terror I was. And what was I telling you about Arizona? ASU, mom went to law school. Oh, my dad.
Yeah.
So with him, I really grew up in powwow culture. And Sac and Fox and Kickapoo were displaced from the from the North Woodlands, Northeastern Woodlands. So you'll see a lot of ribbon work with them and a lot of florals, even though Oklahoma isn't typically known for that. But, you know, going back to Stroud and Davenport for the second Fox Powwow in the summers and dancing, jingle dress, fancy shawl, both different styles of regalia and different dance movements. So I'm pretty lucky I get to dance everything. So I've learned how to make all different types of regalia. I've made grass dance outfits for men, jingle dress outfits, the dresses primarily, fancy shawl for women. I've made a buckskin leather dress, and then a lot of ribbon skirts and a lot of the dance skirts and shawls and capes that we use on the coast. So.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's incredible. I almost feel like you could be like a fashion designer now, incorporating different things. And I mean, I guess you kind of are on some level.
But funny you should say that, because I have done a couple of fashion lines and I've won a couple of prizes. And one of my, I entered into an art show at the Tacoma Art Museum called In the Spirit. And I won, what do they call it? I won the curator's prize. So they bought my piece and they made it part of their permanent collection. So sometimes they'll bring it out and I'll have people, you know, Facebook Messenger me or text me like, hey, I saw this huge button blanket. Was that yours? I'm like, yeah, that was mine. I made that.
That's
so it was it's a 6-foot by 8-foot button blanket. And it tells the story of my family. But I don't know how I did that, because if you've ever sewn, the regular household sewing machine is pretty small. The space between where the needle is and then where the machine housing is, it's not very big. So I had to roll all that wool up, and then you sew around every piece you cut out of the design. So like if this were on there, I would have to sew around all these little points.
Wow.
And my design was a otter, a sea otter, and she was holding her baby. And I had all this kelp, and I had salmon, and I had jellyfish and little bubbles that I sewed onto it, trying to show that she was in the water. But it was pretty intricate design. It took me about a month of straight sewing. But yeah, I still love that piece. It's a good story.
And I would imagine it's, you're meeting people that reach out to you that you would have never met but for that, like, and you learn, you know, more connections and more.
That's one thing I've learned. I need to get more streamlined kind of in my branding, because a lot of things will say my English name. But like if you look me up on Facebook, I'm listed under my Quinault name. And I've always kind of toyed around with what to call kind of my clothing, whether it's regalia or whether it's streetwear, because I do make a lot of streetwear too. And after I graduate, one of my goals is to make a line kind of infusing traditional textiles like the cedar bark, like salmon leather, things like that, and with contemporary fabrics and in really kind of modern, I like the avant-garde kind of crazy design stuff. There's quite a few fashion shows that have been popping up all over Indian country. And so it's one of my goals.
That sounds awesome. That sounds awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, we're kind of at time here and I want to be respectful of your time. I am so excited about the round dance. So I think it's going to be super, super awesome. So when you're on campus, let's connect again, and we'll celebrate you and your MBA and AIE. And yeah, appreciate all you do.
Thank you. Every time you say that I'm going to graduate, do you see my, I just can't help but smile. It's pretty incredible to me that I've been able to do this, and appreciate your support. And you know, the round dance wouldn't be happening without you. And I believe this is the first time Gonzaga will be holding this kind of cultural celebration. And you know, we've recruited singers from Yakima, Spokane, Nez Perce, Colville, and it's going to be a fantastic celebration. So I hope all the Native students and faculty, anybody that's worked with Native students on the campus, join us. Everybody, it's an intertribal. Everybody's welcome to dance, enjoy some food with us, and get to know the MBA AIE students. And yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to share some of my experiences, and you'll be hearing from me when I launch my businesses and any successes we have with our native CDFI.
That's amazing. And I guess the word we use for graduation is commencement, which really means beginning, right? So this is just the beginning. This is your launch. So when you're world famous, just remember that we were friends back when, back in the day. So yeah.
Well, you'll be getting all these invitations to stuff now. So yeah.
All right. All right. Fantastic. All right.
This is my new E. I appreciate it. Hoitmasi. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. All right. Take care.
You too.
Thank you for listening to the G Suite podcast. This episode was produced and hosted by Andrew Brasich and edited by Jack Talbot. To find more G Suite and many other podcasts on the Gonzaga Podcast Network, remember to check out gonzaga.edu/podcasts. Thanks again.